They followed a stone wall, past the remains of an orchard. The trees in their ordered rows gnarled and black, and the fallen limbs thick on the ground. He stopped and looked across the fields, wind in the east, the soft ash moving in the furrows. Stopping, moving again. He'd seen it all before. Shapes of dried blood in the stubble grass, and gray coils of viscera where the slain had been field-dressed and hauled away. The wall beyond held a frieze of human heads, all faced alike, dried and caved with their taut grins and shrunken eyes. They wore gold rings in their leather ears, and in the wind, their sparse and ratty hair twisted about on their skulls. The teeth in their sockets like dental molds, the crude tattoos etched in some home-brewed woad faded in the beggared sunlight. Spiders, swords, targets, a dragon, runic slogans, creeds misspelled. Old scars with old motifs stitched along their borders. The heads, not truncheoned, shapeless, had been flayed of their skins, and the raw skulls painted and signed across the forehead in a scrawl, and one white bone skull had the plates etched carefully in ink like a blueprint for assembly. He looked back at the boy, standing by the cart in the wind. He looked at the dry grass where it moved, and at the dark and twisted trees in their rows. A few shreds of clothing blown against the wall, everything gray in the ash. He walked along past the masks in a last review, and through a stile, and on to where the boy was waiting. He put his arm around his shoulder. "Okay," he said. "Let's go." He'd come to see a message in each such late history, a message and a warning. And so this tableau of the slain and the devoured did prove to be. He woke in the morning and turned over in the blanket and looked back down the road through the trees the way they'd come, in time to see the marchers appear, four abreast. Dressed in clothing of every description, all wearing red scarves at their necks, red or orange, as close to red as they could find. He put his hand on the boy's head. "Shh," he said.
"What is it, Papa?"
"People on the road. Keep your face down. Don't look." No smoke from the dead fire. Nothing to be seen of the cart. He wallowed into the ground and lay watching across his forearm. An army in tennis shoes, tramping. Carrying 3-foot lengths of pipe with leather wrappings, lanyards at the wrist. Some of the pipes were threaded through with lengths of chain fitted at their ends with every manner of bludgeon. They clanked past, marching, with a swaying gait like wind-up toys, bearded, their breath smoking through their masks.
"Shh,"
he said.
"Shh."
The phalanx following carried spears or lances tasseled with ribbons, the long blades hammered out of truck springs in some crude forge upcountry. The boy lay with his face in his arms, terrified. They passed some 200 feet away, the ground shuddering lightly, tramping. Behind them came wagons drawn by slaves in harness and piled with goods of war, and after that the women, perhaps a dozen in number, some of them pregnant, and lastly a supplementary consort of catamites, ill-clothed against the cold, and fitted in dog collars and yoked each to each. All passed on. They lay listening.
"Are they gone, Papa?"
"Yes, they're gone."
"Did you see them?"
"Yes."
"Were they the bad guys?"
"Yes, they were the bad guys."
"There's a lot of them, those bad guys."
"Yes, there are. But they're gone. They stood and brushed themselves off, listening to the silence in the distance.
Where are they going, Papa?
I don't know. They're on the move. It's not a good sign.
Why isn't it a good sign?
It just isn't. We need to get the map and take a look. They pulled the cart from the brush with which they'd covered it, and he raised it up and piled the blankets in and the coats, and they pushed on out to the road and stood looking where the last of that ragged horde seemed to hang like an afterimage in the disturbed air. In the afternoon, it started to snow again. They stood watching the pale gray flakes sift down out of the sullen murk. They trudged on, a frail slush forming over the dark surface of the road. The boy kept falling behind, and he stopped and waited for him. "Stay with me," he said.
"You walk too fast."
"I'll go slower." They went on. "You're not talking again."
"I'm talking."
"You want to stop?"
"I always want to stop."
"We have to be more careful. I have to be more careful."
"I know."
"We'll stop. Okay?"
"Okay."
"We just have to find a place."
"Okay."
The falling snow curtained them about. There was no way to see anything at either side of the road. He was coughing again, and the boy was shivering. The two of them, side by side, under the sheet of plastic, pushing the grocery cart through the snow. Finally, he stopped. The boy was shaking uncontrollably.
"We have to stop," he said.
"It's really cold."
"I know."
"Where are we?"
"Where are we?"
"Yes."
"I don't know."
"If we're going to die, would you tell me?"
"I don't know. We're not going to die." They left the cart overturned in a field of sedge, and he took the coats and the blankets wrapped in the plastic tarp, and they set out. "Hold on to my coat," he said. "Don't let go." They crossed through the sedge to a fence and climbed through, holding down the wire for each other with their hands. The wire was cold, and it creaked in the staples. It was darkening fast. They went on. What they came to was a cedar wood, the trees dead and black, but still full enough to hold the snow. Beneath each one, a precious circle of dark earth and cedar duff. They settled under a tree and piled the blankets and coats on the ground, and he wrapped the boy in one of the blankets and set to raking up the dead needles in a pile. He kicked a cleared space in the snow where the fire wouldn't set the tree alight, and he carried more wood from the other trees, breaking off the limbs and shaking away the snow. When he struck the lighter to the rich tinder, the fire crackled instantly, and he knew that it wouldn't last long. He looked at the boy.
"I've got to go for more wood," he said. "I'll be in the neighborhood, okay?"
"Where's the neighborhood?"
"It just means I won't be far."
"Okay."
The snow by now was half a foot on the ground. He floundered out through the trees, pulling up the fallen branches where they stuck out of the snow, and by the time he had an armload and made his way back to the fire, it had burned down to a nest of quaking embers. He threw the branches on the fire and set out again, hard to stay ahead. The woods were getting dark, and the firelight didn't reach far. If he hurried, he only grew faint. When he looked behind him, the boy was trudging through snow halfway to his knees, pulling up limbs and piling them in his arms. The snow fell, nor did it cease to fall. He woke all night and got up and coaxed the fire to life again. He'd unfolded the tarp and propped one end of it up beneath the tree to try and reflect back the heat from the fire. He looked at the boy's face sleeping in the orange light, the sunken cheeks streaked with black. He fought back the rage. Useless. He didn't think the boy could travel much more. Even if it stopped snowing, the road would be all but impassable. The snow whispered down in the stillness, and the sparks rose and dimmed and died in the eternal blackness. He was half asleep when he heard a crashing in the woods. Then another. He sat up. The fire was down to scattered flames among the embers. He listened. The long, dry crack of shearing limbs. Then another crash. He reached and shook the boy. "Wake up," he said. "We have to go." He rubbed the sleep from his eyes with the backs of his hands.
"What is it?" he said. "What is it, Papa?"
"Come on. We have to move."
"What is it?"
"It's the trees. They're falling down." The boy sat up and looked about wildly. "It's all right," the man said. "Come on. We need to hurry."
He scooped up the bedding and he folded it and wrapped the tarp around it. He looked up. The snow drifted into the eyes. The fire was little more than coals, and it gave no light, and the wood was all but gone, and the trees were falling all about them in the blackness. The boy clung to him. They moved away, and he tried to find a clear space in the darkness, but finally he put down the tarp, and they just sat and pulled the blankets over them, and he held the boy against him. The whoomp of the falling trees and the low boom of the loads of snow exploding on the ground set the woods to shuddering. He held the boy and told him it would be all right and that it would stop soon, and after a while it did. The dull bedlam dying in the distance, and again solitary and far away. Then nothing.
"There," he said. "I think that's it."
He dug a tunnel under one of the fallen trees, scooping away the snow with his arms, his frozen hands clawed inside his sleeves. They dragged in their bedding, and he laid out the tarp, and after a while, they managed to sleep again, for all the bitter cold. When day broke, he pushed his way out of their den, the tarp heavy with snow. He stood and looked about. It had stopped snowing, and the cedar trees lay about in hillocks of snow and broken limbs and a few standing trunks that stood stripped and burnt-looking in that graying landscape. He trudged out through the drifts, leaving the boy to sleep under the tree like some hibernating animal. The snow was almost to his knees. In the field, the dead sedge was drifted almost out of sight, and the snow stood in razor kerfs atop the fence wires, and the silence was breathless. He stood leaning on a post, coughing. He'd little idea where the cart was, and he thought that he was getting stupid, and that his head wasn't working right.
"Concentrate," he said. "You have to think."
When he turned to go back, the boy was calling him.
"We have to go," he said. "We can't stay here."
The boy stared bleakly at the gray drifts.
"Come on."
They made their way out to the fence.
"Where are we going?"
the boy said.
"We have to find the cart."
He just stood there, his hands in the armpits of his parka.
"Come on," the man said. "You have to come on."
He waded out across the drifted fields. The snow lay deep and gray. Already there was a fresh fall of ash on it. He struggled on a few more feet and then turned and looked back. The boy had fallen. He dropped the armful of blankets and the tarp and went back and picked him up. He was already shivering. He picked him up and held him.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry."
They were a long time finding the cart. He pulled it upright out of the drifts and dug out the knapsack and shook it out and opened it and stuffed in one of the blankets. He put the pack and the other blankets and the coats in the basket and picked up the boy and set him on top and unlaced his shoes and pulled them off. Then he got out his knife and set about cutting up one of the coats and wrapping the boy's feet. He used the entire coat, and then he cut big squares of plastic out of the tarp and gathered them up from underneath and wrapped and tied them at the boy's ankles with the lining from the coat sleeves. He stood back. The boy looked down.
"Now you, Papa," he said.
He wrapped one of the coats around the boy, and then he sat on the tarp in the snow and wrapped his own feet. He stood and warmed his hands inside his parka, and then packed their shoes into the knapsack along with the binoculars and the boy's truck. He shook out the tarp and folded it and tied it with the other blankets on top of the pack and shouldered it up and then took a last look through the basket, but that was it.
"Let's go," he said.
The boy took one last look back at the cart and then followed him out to the road. It was harder going even than he would have guessed. In an hour, they'd made perhaps a mile. He stopped and looked back at the boy. The boy stopped and waited.
"You think we're going to die, don't you?"
"I don't know."
"We're not going to die."
"Okay."
"But you don't believe me."
"I don't know."
"Why do you think we're going to die?"
"I don't know."
"Stop saying I don't know."
"Okay."
"Why do you think we're going to die?"
"We don't have anything to eat."
"We'll find something."
"Okay."
"How long do you think people can go without food?"
"I don't know."
"But how long do you think?"
"Maybe a few days."
"And then what? You fall over dead?"
"Yes."
"Well, you don't. It takes a long time. We have water. Now, that's the most important thing. You don't last very long without water."
"Okay."
"But you don't believe me."
"I don't know."
He studied him, standing there with his hands in the pockets of the outsized pinstriped suit coat.
"Do you think I lie to you?"
"No."
"But you think I might lie to you about dying?"
"Yes."
"Okay, I might. But we're not dying."
"Okay."
He studied the sky. There were days when the ashen overcast thinned, and now the standing trees along the road made the faintest of shadows over the snow. They went on. The boy wasn't doing well. He stopped and checked his feet and retied the plastic. When the snow started to melt, it was going to be hard to keep their feet dry. They stopped often to rest. He'd no strength to carry the child. They sat on the pack and ate handfuls of the dirty snow. By afternoon, it was beginning to melt. They passed a burned house, just the brick chimney standing in the yard. They were on the road all day, such day as there was, such few hours. They might have covered 3 miles. He thought the road would be so bad that no one would be on it, but he was wrong. They camped almost in the road itself and built a great fire, dragging dead limbs out of the snow and piling them on the flames to hiss and steam. There was no help for it. The few blankets they had wouldn't keep them warm. He tried to stay awake. He'd jerk upright out of his sleep and slap at the ground looking for the pistol. The boy was so thin. Taut face and hollow eyes. A strange beauty. He got up and dragged more wood onto the fire. They walked out to the road and stood. There were tracks in the snow. A wagon. Some sort of wheeled vehicle. Something with rubber tires by the narrow tread marks. Boot prints between the wheels. Someone had passed in the dark going south, in the early dawn at latest, running the road in the night. He stood thinking about that. He walked the tracks carefully. They'd passed within 50 feet of the fire and hadn't even slowed to look. He stood looking back up the road. The boy watched him.
"We need to get out of the road."
"Why, Papa?"
"Someone's coming."
"Is it bad guys?"
"Yes." "I'm afraid so."
"They could be good guys, couldn't they?"
He didn't answer. He looked at the sky out of old habit, but there was nothing to see.
"What are we going to do, Papa?"
"Let's go."
"Can we go back to the fire?"
"No, come on. We probably don't have much time."
"I'm really hungry."
"I know."
"What are we going to do?"
"We have to hole up. Get off the road."
"Will they see our tracks?"
"Yes."
"What can we do about it?"
"I don't know."
"Will they know what we are?"
"What?"
If they see our tracks, will they know what we are?"
He looked back at their great, round tracks in the snow. "They'll figure it out," he said. Then he stopped. "We need to think about this. Let's go back to the fire." He'd thought that they might find some place in the road where the snow had melted off completely. But then he thought that since their tracks wouldn't reappear on the far side, it'd be no help. They kicked snow over the fire and went on through the trees and circled and came back. They hurried, leaving a maze of tracks, and then they set out back north through the woods, keeping the road in view. The site they picked was the highest ground they came to, and it gave views north along the road and overlooked their backtrack. He spread the tarp in the wet snow and wrapped the boy in the blankets. "You're going to be cold," he said, "but maybe we won't be here long." Within the hour, two men came down the road almost at a lope. When they'd passed, he stood up to watch them, and when he did, they stopped, and one of them looked back. He froze. He was wrapped in one of the gray blankets, and he'd have been hard to see, but not impossible. But he thought probably they'd smelled the smoke. They stood talking. Then they went on. He sat down. "It's okay," he said. "We just have to wait. But I think it's okay." They'd had no food and little sleep in 5 days. And in this condition, on the outskirts of a small town, they came upon a once grand house, sited on a rise above the road. The boy stood, holding his hand. The snow was largely melted on the macadam and in the south-facing fields and woods. They stood there. The plastic bags over their feet had long since worn through, and their feet were wet and cold. The house was tall and stately, with white Doric columns across the front, a porte cochere at the side, a gravel drive that curved up through a field of dead grass. The windows were oddly intact.
"What is this place, Papa?"
"Shh. Let's just stand here and listen." There was nothing. The wind rustling the dead roadside bracken, a distant creaking door or shutter. "Let's take a look."
"Papa, let's not go up there."
"It's okay." "I don't think we should go up there." "It's okay. We have to take a look." They approached slowly up the drive. No tracks in the random skiffs of melting snow. A tall hedge of dead privet. An ancient bird's nest lodged in the dark wicker of it. They stood in the yard studying the facade. The handmade brick of the house kilned out of the dirt it stood on. The peeling paint hung in long, dry sleevings down the columns and from the buckled soffits. A lamp from a long chain overhead. The boy clung to him as they climbed the steps. One of the windows was slightly open, and a cord ran from it, and across the porch to vanish in the grass. He held the boy's hand, and they crossed the porch. Chattel slaves had once trod those boards bearing food and drink on silver trays. They went to the window and looked in.
"What if there's someone here, Papa?"
"There's no one here."
"We should go, Papa."
"We've got to find something to eat. We have no choice."
"We could find something somewhere else."
"It's gonna be all right. Come on." He took the pistol from his belt and tried the door. It swung slowly in on its great brass hinges. They stood listening. Then they stepped into a broad foyer, floored in a domino of black and white marble tiles. A broad staircase ascending, fine Morris paper on the walls, water-stained and sagging. The plaster ceiling bellied in great swags, and the yellow dental molding bowed and sprung from the upper walls.
To the left, through the doorway, stood a large walnut buffet in what must have been the dining room. The doors and the drawers were gone, but the rest of it was too large to burn. They stood in the doorway. Piled in a windrow in one corner of the room was a heap of clothing. Clothes and shoes, belts, coats, blankets, and old sleeping bags. He'd have ample time later to think about that. The boy hung onto his hand. He was terrified. They crossed the foyer to the room on the far side and walked in and stood. A great hall of a room with ceilings twice the height of the doors. A fireplace with raw brick showing where the wooden mantel and surround had been pried away and burned. There were mattresses and bedding arranged on the floor in front of the hearth. "Papa," the boy whispered. "Shh," he said. The ashes were cold. Some blackened pots stood about. He squatted on his heels and picked one up and smelled it and put it back. He stood and looked out the window to the side of the house. Gray trampled grass, gray snow. The cord that came through the window was tied to a brass bell, and the bell was fixed in a rough wooden jig that had been nailed to the window molding. He held the boy's hand, and they went down a narrow back hallway into the kitchen. Trash piled everywhere. A rust-stained sink, smell of mold and excrement. They went on into the adjoining small room, perhaps a pantry. In the floor of this room was a doorway, or hatch, and it was locked with a large padlock made of stacked steel plates. He stood looking at it.
"Papa,"
the boy said,
"we should go."
"Papa?"
"There's a reason this is locked."
The boy pulled at his hand. He was almost in tears.
"Papa,"
he said, "we've got to eat."
"I'm not hungry, Papa, I'm not."
"We need to find a pry bar or something."
They pushed out through the back door, the boy hanging on to him. He shoved the pistol in his belt and stood looking out over the yard. There was a brick walkway in the twisted and wiry shape of what once had been a row of boxwoods. In the yard was an old iron harrow, propped up off the ground on piers of stacked brick, and someone had wedged in the rails of it a 40-gallon cast-iron cauldron of the kind once used for rendering hogs. Underneath were the ashes of a fire and blackened billets of wood. At one side, a small wagon with rubber tires. All these things he saw and didn't see. At the far side of the yard was an old wooden smokehouse and a tool shed. He crossed, half dragging the child, and went sorting through tools standing in a barrel under the shed roof. He came up with a long-handled spade and hefted it in his hand. "Come on," he said. Back in the house, he chopped at the wood around the hasp staple and finally jammed the blade under the staple and pried it up. It was screwed into the wood, and the whole thing came up, lock and all. He kicked the blade of the shovel under the edge of the boards and got his lighter out. Then he stood on the tang of the shovel and raised the edge of the hatch and leaned and got hold of it.
"Papa,"
the boy whispered. He stopped.
"Listen to me," he said. "Just stop it. We're starving. Do you understand?"
Then he raised the hatch door and swung it over and let it down on the floor behind.
"Just wait here," he said.
"I'm going with you."
"I thought you were scared."
"I am scared."
"Okay. Just stay close behind me."
He started down the rough wooden steps. He ducked his head and then flicked the lighter and swung the flame out over the darkness like an offering. Coldness and damp, an ungodly stench. The boy clutched at his coat. He could see part of a stone wall, clay floor, an old mattress darkly stained. He crouched and stepped down again and held out the light. Huddled against the back wall were naked people. male and female, all trying to hide, shielding their faces with their hands. On the mattress lay a man with his legs gone to the hip and the stumps of them blackened and burnt. The smell was hideous.
"Jesus,"
he whispered. Then, one by one, they turned and blinked in the pitiful light.
"Help us," they whispered. "Please help us."
"Christ," he said. "Oh, Christ."
He turned and grabbed the boy.
"Hurry," he said. "Hurry."
He dropped the lighter. No time to look. He pushed the boy up the stairs.
"Help us,"
they called.
"Hurry."
A bearded face appeared, blinking at the foot of the stairs.
"Please," he called. "Please.
Hurry. For God's sake, hurry."
He shoved the boy through the hatch and sent him sprawling. He stood and got hold of the door and swung it over and let it fall. And he turned to grab the boy, but the boy had gotten up and was doing his little dance of terror.
"For the love of God, will you come on?"
he hissed. But the boy was pointing out the window. And when he looked, he went cold all over. Coming across the field toward the house were four bearded men and two women. He grabbed the boy by the hand.
"Christ," he said. "Run, run!"
They tore through the house to the front door and down the steps. Halfway down the drive, he dragged the boy into the field. He looked back. They had some shelter from the ruins of the privet, but he knew they had minutes at most, and maybe no minutes at all. At the bottom of the field, they crashed through a stand of dead cane and out into the road and crossed into the woods on the far side. He redoubled his grip on the boy's wrist and glanced at him briefly. He looked like something out of a death camp.
"Run," he whispered. "We have to run."
He looked toward the house, but he could see nothing. If they came down the drive, they'd see him running through the naked trees with the boy.
"This is the moment. This is the moment."
He fell to the ground and pulled the boy to him.
"Shh," he said. "Shh. Are they gonna kill us? Papa?"
They lay in the leaves and the ash with their hearts pounding. He was going to start coughing. He'd have put his hand over his mouth, but the boy was holding on to his hand and wouldn't let go, and in the other hand he was holding the pistol. He had to concentrate to stifle the cough, and at the same time he was trying to listen. He swung his chin through the leaves, trying to see what was out there.
"Keep your head down," he whispered. "Are they coming?"
"No."
They crawled slowly through the leaves toward what looked like lower ground. He lay listening, holding the boy. He could hear them, out on the road, talking. Voice of a woman. Then he heard them in the dry leaves. He took the boy's hand and pushed the revolver into it.
"Take it," he whispered. "Take it."
The boy was terrified. He put his arm around him and held him. His body so thin.
"Don't be afraid," he said. "If they find you, you are going to have to do it. Do you understand? Shh, no crying. Do you hear me? You know how to do it. You put it in your mouth and point it up. Do it quick and hard. Do you understand? Stop crying. Do you understand?"
"I think so."
"No. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Say, yes, I do, Papa."
"Yes, I do, Papa."
He looked down at him. All he saw was terror. He took the gun from him.
"No, you don't," he said.
"I don't know what to do, Papa. I don't know what to do. Where will you be?"
"It's okay.
I don't know what to do."
"Shh. I'm right here,"
I won't leave you.
You promise?
Yes, I promise.
I was going to run, to try and lead them away, but I can't leave you.
Papa?
Shh. Stay down.
I'm so scared.
They lay listening. Can you do it when the time comes? When the time comes, there'll be no time. Now is the time. Curse God and die. What if it doesn't fire? It has to fire. What if it doesn't fire? Could you crush that beloved skull with a rock? Is there such a being within you of which you know nothing? Can there be? Hold him in your arms, just so. The soul is quick. Pull him toward you, kiss him quickly. He waited, the small nickel-plated revolver in his hand. He was going to cough. He put his whole mind to holding it back. He tried to listen, but he could hear nothing.
I won't leave you, he whispered. I won't ever leave you. Do you understand?
He held the trembling child in the leaves, clutching the revolver. They lay all through the long dusk and into the dark, cold and starless. Blessed. He began to believe they had a chance.
We just have to wait, he whispered. So cold.
He tried to think, but his mind swam. He was so weak. All his talk about running, he couldn't run. When it was truly black about them, he unfastened the straps on the backpack and pulled out the blankets and spread them over the boy, and soon the boy was sleeping. In the night, he heard hideous shrieks coming from the house, and he tried to put his hands over the boy's ears, and after a while, the screaming stopped. He lay listening. Coming through the cane break into the road, he'd seen a box, a thing like a child's playhouse. He realized it was where they watched the road, lying in wait and ringing the bell in the house for their companions to come. He dozed and woke.
What's coming?
Footsteps in the leaves.
No. Just the wind. Nothing.
He sat up and looked toward the house, but he could see only darkness. He shook the boy awake.
Come on, he said. We have to go.
The boy didn't answer, but he knew he was awake. He pulled the blankets free and strapped them onto the knapsack.
Come on, he whispered.
They set out through the dark woods. There was a moon somewhere beyond the ashen overcast, and they could just make out the trees. They staggered on like drunks.
If they find us, they'll kill us, won't they, Papa?
Shh.
No more talking.
Won't they, Papa?
Shh.
Yes.
Yes, they will.
He'd no idea what direction they might have taken, and his fear was that they might circle and return to the house. He tried to remember if he knew anything about that, or if it were only a fable. In what direction did lost men veer? Perhaps it changed with hemispheres. Handedness. Finally, he put it out of his mind, the notion that there could be anything to correct for. His mind was betraying him. Phantoms not heard from in 1,000 years, rousing slowly from their sleep. Correct for that. The boy was tottering on his feet. He asked to be carried, stumbling and slurring his words, and the man did carry him, and he fell asleep on his shoulder instantly. And he knew he couldn't carry him far. He woke in the dark of the woods in the leaves, shivering violently. He sat up and felt about for the boy. He held his hand to the thin ribs, warmth and movement, heartbeat. When he woke again, it was almost light enough to see. He threw back the blanket and stood and almost fell over again. He steadied himself and tried to see about him in the gray woods. How far had they come? He walked to the top of a rise and crouched and watched the day accrue. The charry dawn, the cold, illusid world. In the distant, what looked to be a pine wood, raw and black, a colorless world of wire and crepe. He went back and got the boy and made him sit up. His head kept slumping forward. "We have to go," he said. "We have to go." He carried him across the field, stopping to rest each 50 counted steps. When he got to the pines, he knelt and laid him in the gritty duff and covered him with the blankets and sat watching him. Starved, exhausted, sick with fear. He leaned and kissed him and got up and walked out to the edge of the woods, and then he walked the perimeter round to see if they were safe. Across the fields to the south, he could see the shape of a house and a barn. Beyond the trees, the curve of a road, a long drive with dead grass, dead ivy along a stone wall, and a mailbox and a fence along the road, and the dead trees beyond, cold and silent, shrouded in the carbon fog. He walked back and sat beside the boy. It was desperation that had led him to such carelessness, and he knew that he couldn't do that again, no matter what. The boy wouldn't wake for hours. Still, if he did, he'd be terrified. It had happened before. He thought about waking him, but he knew that he wouldn't remember anything if he did. He'd trained him to lie in the woods like a fawn. For how long? In the end, he took the pistol from his belt and laid it alongside him under the blankets and rose and set out.